This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Find out what documents recently obtained by WGLT say about Bloomington Coliseum business practices. It confirms what former Alderman Judy Stearns has been saying.
What the auditors were telling us is, hey, City of Bloomington, you don't really know how much you are supposed to be getting.
GLT's Ryan Denham also found out there were a lot of verbal agreements between Coliseum management and former city manager Tom Hamilton. Discover why a scholar of graphic novels thinks she's bringing new readers to the genre. Laura Kennedy has that interview. And find out why out-of-state kids might be welcomed to the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy in Aurora. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 26th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As the criminal case against the former managers of the Coliseum moves along, new questions are being raised about their contract with the City of Bloomington. GLT's Ryan Denham has been working on a story published today on WGLT.org based on new documents WGLT News just obtained, showing years of warnings from the city's auditors. Ryan is in the studio to unpack what he's found. Ryan, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Sure thing, Mike.
Ryan, what are these documents that we've obtained, or actually you've obtained?
So the Coliseum was audited every year and continues to be audited every year. And those audits were generally released publicly, posted on the city's website, et cetera. But there was also these other documents as part of the audit process that are sort of notable. And these are the ones that we've obtained. They're essentially letters or memos that accompanied the audits every year. They went into greater detail about the stuff that needed to be fixed year to year. And so the level of seriousness of that stuff varied. So there was minor things like record keeping, just things like that. And there were more serious matters like the nature of the contract itself, segregation of duties, et cetera.
So what do the documents actually show?
Well, I think they show a lot, actually. There are sort of two main threads that you pick up in reading over these letters that were attached to the annual audits. The first one is just the ambiguity of the original management contract that the City of Bloomington had with the Central Illinois Arena Management Company. That was John Butler's company. That's a company called SIAM that they ran the Coliseum for the first 10 years of its existence. And so this ambiguity in the contract is referenced a couple of different times, actually six straight years in these audit letters. Just for example, the auditors say that we recommend the city and SIAM reevaluate the management agreement to, quote, address any areas containing ambiguous language, which may be subject to loose interpretation. And they're like literally talking about some of the stuff that's at the core of the criminal case. So concession fees, commissions, the money that's changing hands between the city and SIAM. So the second thread within these letters that are sort of interesting is documents a series of verbal agreements between the city and SIAM that the auditors found problematic for various reasons. So these are essentially, conversations between city officials and SIAM about how the Coliseum should handle certain things. These are things that you would want to have documented and written in written form as opposed to verbal agreements.
So I have to ask, and you may not have an answer to this question, six straight years of warnings, why didn't the city take any action?
That's a good question. We're having trouble kind of finding out the reason for that. The city has not said a whole lot since the charges were filed because of the case. Contract law is tricky. Maybe they felt they couldn't force SIAM into a contract renegotiation. I don't know.
So how does any of this connect to the criminal case against the five former managers of the arena, including John Butler?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the ambiguity question is really key. So if the auditors are documenting the ambiguity of the contract year after year, that may lend credence to the defense's claim that this is merely a contract dispute, a civil matter that the authorities have made unfairly into a criminal matter. So if that's their argument that, we were just disagreeing about money, guys, then these audit letters would sort of support that theory. Alternatively, maybe this is just sort of a blip in the radar. Maybe prosecutors have sort of a smoking gun in the back that we don't know about yet. That's possible. Another kind of thing that may weigh on the side of the prosecution is These audit letters also mention that SIAM officials basically made unauthorized extraordinary expenses, or legal fees is what they're described as well. Back in 2011, this was documented. And the disguising of expenses in this extraordinary expenses, quote-unquote, description is actually related directly to two of the theft charges against John Butler. So there is a pretty direct connection there. Just kind of what does it mean?
So what are the lawyers saying? The prosecution, the defense attorneys, and the city, I guess. What are they all saying about these documents?
So far, the prosecutors have declined to comment in the last couple of days. It's pretty standard for a case that is pending. So they're reluctant to speak out publicly unless the defense makes some claim out in the media. Same thing with Steve Beckett, who is John Butler's attorney. He says, you know, I can't really speak any more than what my court filings say. But again, those court filings that John Butler has made is making that argument that it was a mere contract civil dispute that they should have resolved over mediation, not the criminal justice system. I spoke to former Alderman Judy Stearns about all this back in the fall. She came in for a studio interview after the charges were filed, and I thought she had some pretty interesting things to say about her level of concern with the contract. I'm going to just play a little bit of audio from our conversation with her.
So what the auditors were telling us is, hey, City of Bloomington, you don't really know how much you are supposed to be getting. And, I mean, that's not proper accountability. That's basic. That's basic.
That's Alderman Judy Stearns here on Sound Ideas. You're listening to GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Ryan Denham. Some of these audits are 10 years old, from 2008. Why did it take so long to see them?
Well, it's sort of hard to tell that they even exist from the outside looking in. The audits themselves reference the letters briefly, but these letters themselves that we've obtained were not actually part of those documents that were already online. So we had to request them from the city through a Freedom of Information Act request. We've been going back and forth with the city on that for about 5 months now. We appealed to the Illinois Attorney General's office to kind of get their support, and then finally last week we were given the documents.
So the city of Bloomington was resistant. Is that a fair characterization?
There was some question about whether the documents existed in the first place. They had trouble finding them originally, and then ultimately they did.
What's the latest with the criminal case? Any closer to a resolution?
Not a resolution, no, but there has been a lot of back and forth. There's some pretty notable filings just over the last month or so. I'll recap a few of them. So Bart Rogers is kind of one of the co-defendants. He was John Butler's number two at the Coliseum, the general manager. He was asked to testify before a grand jury and produce documents recently. So he was served these subpoenas within the last couple of weeks. So the question there is what are prosecutors still looking for, right? There's thousands of documents that are part of discovery already. They're still seeking apparently more testimony, more documents. So where are they going with that? They also recently subpoenaed an orthopedics company based in Peoria, trying to get documents and any communications that they had with Bart Rogers. In parallel to this all these criminal cases against these five folks, there is a civil case. So John Butler has essentially countersued the city and is saying that the city actually owes him money in unpaid commissions back when he was running the Coliseum. A pretty notable filing in that just occurred last week. The former city manager for Bloomington, a guy named David Hales, he left back in November for a new job in Joliet. But again, 2 weeks ago, he actually submitted an affidavit in this civil case denying some claims that John Butler and his attorney had made about what he did or did not authorize during his tenure as city manager. So that's interesting to see him kind of come back into the fold. He's doing a whole different job up in Joliet. Now he's back.
Whether you support the Coliseum or don't, it's not going anywhere. The arena is under new management now. How's it doing?
It's still struggling. They have booked some pretty good shows recently, some pretty notable concerts. I heard a lot of my friends went to the Jim Gaffigan thing, and they've done some good stuff. But also challenges, right? They've had the hockey team, the Central Illinois Flying Aces. They canceled a few of their home games at the beginning of the season so there could be a renovation project in the building that lost – that was lost revenue for the city. The Edge indoor football team, they're tied up in a legal dispute that caused them to cancel their spring season. So that's, again, lost revenue this spring. And if you look at the cold, hard numbers, it's not a pretty picture right now, at least. last year was the first full year that VenueWorks had taken over management from John Butler's company. That year, they lost $668,000in operations. This year, after 9 months, they've lost $718,000. The fiscal year ends here April 30th, so we'll kind of see how they wrap up the year, if it'll be better or worse.
And we know from our past conversations with Mayor Terry Renner and former city manager David Hales that the goal is to they're aiming at break even, and they're certainly not there yet. GLT Digital Content Director Ryan Denham, he's been reporting on the Coliseum case. Ryan, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas. You can read the documents you've been hearing about right now at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Democrat J.B. Pritzker made his primary contest for governor of Illinois look easy. On the Republican side, it wasn't, with challenger Jeannie Ives gaining nearly half the vote against incumbent Governor Bruce Rauner. And that's the topic on this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. Also on the panel are IPR's Brian Mackey, Daisy Contreras, and WBEZ political reporter Tony Arnold. Arnold says the election made the governor look even weaker than before.
It was just so close, and it tightened up, and you could kind of tell from the Rauner campaign's body language that just how they were nervous, or at least a little concerned going into the primary day, how this was going to shake out. And over the last few days, just looking at the results here of how Rauner ended up doing, it's noteworthy that State Representative Jeannie Ives won most of the collar counties around Cook County, which the Republican, no matter who it is going to really need those areas come November to be the Democrat in this state. And to see that Rauner won Cook County and Lake County, but not DuPage, Will, Kane, McHenry, Kendall, that just means he's got a lot of work to do to heal these wounds in the Republican Party. And right now, it seems like a lot of people on the Ives side are not anxious to be healing those wounds, I should say.
And Brian, I think that she's not, at least as the time we sat down here, apparently is not conceded in the race yet for governor. So.
Well, I mean, she's conceded that she lost, but she hasn't done the thing where you call the person and say we're going to work together and let's come together as a party and friend of the show Dave McKinney had the story the other day where he asked her who would be the better governor, right, Bruce Rauner or J.B. Pritzker, and she wasn't ready to answer that question, really. I mean, she has said, well, I'm a Republican. I'll support the governor eventually, but she is not really endorsing him and not looking like she's going to be doing a lot to bring the party together.
And Daisy, hasn't she said that she will vote for him, but she will not endorse him,
right,
nor will she campaign with
right
him?
Right, exactly.
Well, Daisy, the governor did say, I believe, after this was all over, that he's heard from that side of the party, that wing of the party, that they're not happy with him, and he's heard that message. What message has he heard?
Well, he hasn't really been clear as to what really that message is. He knows that they're unhappy with him, but he won't give specifics. I mean, even Jeannie Ives, during her campaign, she gave those specifics. She said that the Republican, those Republicans that were going for her, that were supporting her, were unhappy with Rauner's decision on the abortion bill that he signed. They're unhappy with his stance on immigration, on sanctuary cities. And so, yeah, I mean, he won't give those specifics, but he really wants Jeannie Ives' base to go and follow him.
And just to be clear, he has not come around and said, you know, I made a mistake by signing this legislation or these taking a certain position, or he's not indicated anything like that.
Oh, no, no. He wants everyone to just kind of follow him on the things that they do agree on, like putting in term limits, things like that, that he's been talking for the last couple of months.
And I would say there's a couple other interesting things to stop and think about that Jeannie Hives talked about. One, she would not denounce the tax increase. I mean, she says, yes, we should have lower taxes in Illinois eventually. But in the short term, she says the amount of debt we have is immoral. And so she is one who would not say, yes, I vow to cut taxes no matter what, because she's concerned with the amount of Illinois' unpaid bills. And she used that word, immoral. Another thing she criticized the governor for is his fixation on House Speaker Michael Madigan and blaming him for what I've said was his own failures. And so I wonder if that's the message the governor heard, because that kind of goes directly against exactly what he started campaigning on, right? You know, the morning after both he and Pritzker, which we can get to later, the emails were timestamped, interestingly, I thought, 8:29 and 8:30 on Wednesday morning from the two of them. Here's our attack ads. We're starting the fall campaign already.
Charlie, Jeannie Hives, let's give her her due. I mean, she nearly got half the vote in that Republican primary. But at the same time, was this more about Bruce Rauner or about any message she had?
Oh, I think it was very much about Bruce Rauner. And I think there were a couple elements. We've already discussed the fact, as Daisy pointed out, he signed a couple of bills that are really abhorrent to a lot of conservative people who are very strongly pro-life and who are very much anti-immigrant. And so there's that group that he totally alienated. As a matter of fact, the abortion bill was the straw that broke the camel's back, to use the old cliche, and got Jeannie Hives into the race in the first place. But I think there were also a lot of other people who voted for Jeannie Hives who those two issues may not have been make-or-break issues, but who resented the fact that Bruce Rauner is such a liar and that he lied about those particular, well, not necessarily the immigration bill, but he certainly lied about the abortion bill when he told conservative lawmakers, Hives included, and when he even told the Cardinal of Chicago, Blaise Cupich, that he was going to veto that bill, and then he turned around and signed it. So there's these people who are very disenchanted with Bruce Rauner and who are probably not going to vote for J.B. Pritzker. And I think for the Rauner camp, the concern has to be that these folks are just going to stay home, or if they do go out to vote, they're going to take a pass on the governor's race in November.
Well, you mentioned, you know, that some feel that he lied over this, or he at least was not upfront about what his plan was. In that respect, that we've seen governors throughout the years who will say one thing and then they say, after further study, I've come to a different conclusion on it. Isn't that fair to say that he could have done that?
I can't recall another governor who has flat out lied to his face to the head of the Catholic population in the Archdiocese of Chicago. And to follow up on that, yeah, politicians always say stuff. Anybody who believes the ads that they see, that they've been inundated with, and the flyers and the garbage, anybody who believes that is really very gullible, I guess, to be charitable.
But Brian, aren't there people who favor those positions? I mean, in fairness, I mean, yes, he may have angered those folks. Is he gaining anything from the other side who might say, hey, I agree with the governor on these things?
Well, I doubt it, though. And the reason I say that is because those are, in today's Democratic Party, those are kind of basic issues. It's almost like a litmus test to be a Democrat, you have to be pro-choice. So he's not going to win any favor with those people who have a long list of reasons of why they think he doesn't deserve a second term. And I was going to say, you can't believe the advertising, but in dealings with individual legislators and leaders, there has to be a certain level of trust. I think Rauner has broken this. And there are some issues where you just don't lie flat out the way that he had on several occasions to the people who he needs to support him in the General Assembly.
I do think, to give the governor his due, that his position on abortion is a sincerely held one. I mean,
he had
answered a questionnaire in the 2014 campaign basically saying that he would do just the thing he did in terms of signing the bill to expand public funding for people on Medicaid or state employees of abortion. But, you know, it is this question, Charlie, about, you know, him lying. Now, it's interesting that some Republican lawmakers are willing to get back on board. I saw State Representative Peter Breen quoted this week, who is probably one of the most anti-abortion legislators in the – I mean, he literally was a lawyer and still is doing legal work for the Thomas More Society, which is a Catholic legal organization that often goes to court to challenge abortion laws, and in fact is the lead lawyer challenging this very abortion law that the governor signed. But he said he was now supporting the governor in the fall campaign after having supported Ives. But there are others who will not. And, you know, it's still – you know, we haven't even talked about the national mood and Democratic – hopes for increased turnout driven by President Trump, but the governor has his work cut out for him this year.
Just keep in mind too, to Brian's point, that Rauner campaigned on this in 2014. Rauner's been basically trying to run a general election campaign since 2017. I think he kind of overlooked Representative Ives in many ways to look forward to what it would take for a Republican to be reelected in Illinois in 2018 when you're up against the attitudes toward Trump, which in Illinois are very strong against him. He does not poll well and everything else. And so Rauner basically took the campaign ads that are inevitable come October from Democrats. They happen every election cycle for governor that say that are geared toward women voters. And by signing that abortion bill, he's taken those ads off the table for Democrats to use.
And I was just emphasize a point Tony made earlier, too, about the body language of the Rauner campaign heading into the primary and how nervous they were getting. I think it's interesting to look back now on that bill he vetoed last week about licensing gun dealers and thinking of that in the context of whatever internal polling he was seeing show in the race, because we have not had as much public polling in this year. And I don't know if that's because, you know, frankly, the Tribune and other media organizations that usually do that sort of thing are in tighter fiscal times. We just haven't had as much public polling. And so you think of that, and then it was certainly apparent from the number of emails that he sent to his supporters. You know, I think there were six of them at three-hour intervals all day on election day. He was doing radio interviews. You know, candidates usually kind of step back on election day and let the voting play out as it is, I think. But his campaign at least was aggressively trying to get people to the polls, and it shows with only a 20,000 vote margin that was probably a smart thing.
IPR's Brian Mackey, along with Daisy Contreras and Sean Crawford, and WBEZ reporter Tony Arnold on the Illinois Politics Roundtable here on GLT's Sound Ideas. On Sound Ideas, get a walk through a new photography exhibit at University Galleries and find out what gives the photographer inspiration. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A scholar of comic books and graphic novels delves into the world of an artist and feels she's bringing new readers to the genre. Laura Kennedy has more.
The 2018 Lois Lenski Children's Literature Lecture at Illinois State University features a scholar who specializes in comics and graphic novels. Lan Dong teaches at the University of Illinois Springfield and is speaking on the award-winning Jean Luen Yang, an enormously popular graphic novelist who interpolates the experience of a mixed culture background into his work, which includes contributing to Superman in the DC Universe. A great admirer of Yang, Lang Dong grew up in China and attended graduate school in the U.S. It was there that Dong became intrigued by children's literature and its impact on readers. When it came time to write her dissertation, Dong combined her new fascination with her own culture and researched the warrior Mulan.
Because of her figure is so prominent in China and in the United States.
Yes, because of the Disney movie.
Yes, precisely. So I found out her story has so many variations and adaptations, not only in literary forms, in different genres, but also has a very strong presence in children's literature in terms of picture books, illustrated chapter books, animated films, not just the Disney one. Disney movie is the best known, but there are a few lower budget production animation films about Mulan released here in the States. That's what drew me to children's literature, and that also kind of opened the door for me to go back and revisit some of the children's books. When we go back and read and reread those books as adults, we pick out new things and realize how complex things can be.
You did your studies on children's literature here in the United States. Is the study of children's literature popular in China right now, or has that yet to catch on?
I think it may have a little bit catch up to do. It is a subject. There are college level classes in children's literature.
You do comic studies and you teach graphic novels at the U of I Springfield. And I'm wondering, why is it important to study graphic novels for young students today?
There are a few reasons. First of all, comics historically had a not very well-respected reputation.
Yeah.
We think of comics as something silly and funny, not serious, which is not the case. So that's one of the reasons. And number two, there has been an increase of publication in book-length comics, which commonly known as graphic novels. They address a variety of subject matter. Some of them are deadly serious. So there are a lot of materials available. And the other reason I found out from teaching, my class on comics and graphic novel actually came out of students' request. When I first started teaching, I would incorporate maybe one graphic novel in a literature class. For example, if I teach a class on introduction to literature, I would use maybe R. Spiegelman's Mouse.
Ah, yes, set during the Holocaust.
That's a very famous landmark work. Then if I teach a class on memoir, I may include Minio Kubo's Citizen 13660. That's less known, but it's a very important work in Asian American literature. After a while, some of my students ask me, they're really intrigued, they're very interested. So they ask me if I would be willing to develop a whole class based on graphic novels.
What can students do with the information that they get from graphic novels?
I think those visual elements included in graphic novels force students to look at things in front of their eyes. So it provides this sense of immediacy. They can't just put it down and ignore it. It also provides almost like a window looking into historical events. For example, prominent figures, making the reader feel like a witness, going through the same events together with the narrator. Well, for example, I use Joe Sacco's Safe Area Garage Door in one of my classes. A number of students over the years has told me they, when you read a very dark part of the story, they had to put the book down.
Was it too overwhelming?
Because it's so overwhelming, it's too traumatic. Even though the book is not in color, you still can see because of the different usage of shades, and they can literally see the blood on the page, even though they're not like red blood on the page. But because of the shading, they can tell there's a genocide happening in the story. It's just so overwhelming. They have to put it down, take a break, compose themselves and go back to the book. So that's the power of the visual narrative.
One of the most popular graphic novelists out there is Jean Luen Yang.
Yes.
In 2016, the Library of Congress named him the Ambassador for Young People's Literature, and he's the third graphic novelist ever to receive a MacArthur Fellowship. And you're going to be talking about him in your Lois Lenski Children's Literature Lecture. Tell me, why did you choose him?
I have a very long interest in his work. I think he is a very important figure in comic studies in general and in Asian American comics and graphic novels in particular, partly because what you mentioned, he is really well known. His visibility helped bring readers' attention to comics and graphic novels. He is a very strong advocate for the educational value of comics. Wherever he goes, he's made so many public appearances at conferences, library readings, book signing, and including these high profile because of all the awards and other honors he's received. He always takes the opportunity to advocate for comics, making readers to be aware how valuable they could be. This doesn't mean we don't read other books. We just read comics. This means don't brush them aside just because their format is in comics.
He has this strong spiritual streak. There's a lot of spirituality in his
work. He grew up Chinese-American Catholic in the Bay Area. So spirituality is part of his upbringing. And because of his background with Chinese heritage and Catholic upbringing, he also kind of combines different influences in terms of religion and spirituality in his work, which we can see in American-born Chinese already. He talks about the Buddha. He talks about the creation and different elements that really is not only rooted in Buddhism, but you can see Christianity in that. Later on, when he published The Boxers and Saints, that's a two-volume set, talking about the Taiping Rebellion in China, he really brings that more to the surface. He talked about how those books were inspired by his church when they had this huge celebration when the Catholic Church canonized several Chinese saints in the first time ever in their history. They had a huge celebration, and he realized that he's never heard about these saints. He had no idea what they did, and then he did a little bit of research and found out most of them lived during this very chaotic period in Chinese history. That's where those two books are coming out of, and where he put together the Buddhist goddess Guan Yin and the Jesus figure in those two books, because they share something in common, that's compassion.
That's very interesting that he's getting this hybridization going on with different streams of spirituality.
In a lot of his works, he really combines his bicultural heritage. I was reading the new Superman of his from DC Comics last night. He put several of the very well-known DC comic figures in Shanghai, China, and kind of reinvented these stories.
You mentioned earlier American-born Chinese that Gene Young had written. Is this a good place to get started if we want to get to know his work? Is this a great way to get to know him as a creator?
Yes, absolutely. That's his breakthrough work because it has reached a very wide range of audience and has won big name awards, and it's probably one of his best known book. And it's also really accessible, I think, to readers of different ages. You don't have to have an immigrant background to identify with the main character, as long as you feel like you're a little different from the crowd in whatever way, I think they would be able to identify with the characters.
That's Long Dong, the 2018 Lois Lenski Children's Literature Lecturer, who will appear tonight at 7 o'clock in Stevenson Hall, Room 101 on the Illinois State University campus. I'm Laura Kennedy.
To get started reading graphic novels, Lan Dong recommends Mouse by Art Spiegelman and American-Born Chinese by Jane Yang. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Every morning you open your eyes and your ears to a world full of new stories.
Gates is expected to change his plea to guilty.
Students and the police were describing a person. The person they picked up seems...
There are tens of thousands of people gathering in Florida to watch this thing take off.
It can be a lot to absorb when you're just getting out of bed in the morning, but we can do it together. Start every day fully awake with Morning Edition.
Hear Morning Edition at 4 a.m. on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. News of Toys R Us closing stores in the U.S. broke last week, including the one in Bloomington and 23 others in Illinois. It's the latest in a string of retail chains downsizing or going out of business. Illinois Issues' Mary Hansen explores whether the state is ready for the shift.
Other big-name retailers that have announced closures include Sears, Sam's Club, and most recently Carson's. They've left behind hundreds of workers in Illinois, and it's left some to wonder, what gives?
Here we are in a period of, you know, good economic growth, and yet stores are closing. And so that suggests that retailers like Sam's Club are rethinking how retail happens.
That's Christopher Merritt, director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs at Western Illinois University. He says the rise in online shopping means retailers are changing their business models, shuttering brick-and-mortar stores, and focusing on the web. One example is Sam's Club. The subscription wholesaler is owned by Walmart and announced in January it will close dozens of its stores nationwide, including seven in Illinois. The superstore has promised a few of the Sam's Clubs around the country will be converted to online fulfillment centers. There hasn't been an indication of whether any of those centers would be in Illinois. The shift to e-commerce is just one factor to blame. Rob Carr is the president of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. He says many chains have overbuilt, fueled by low interest rates and private equity firms that thought retail could only expand.
So that has led to a bubble, if you will, and I think we're seeing a correction.
Carr says Illinois is part of a nationwide trend, but in a state that continues to see residents move out, it's a little worse off.
Our population is contracting. Every time somebody leaves the state, they take with them their disposable income and their sales, and they're now making those wherever they're moving to.
It's not only residents Illinois is losing. There are thousands of lost jobs, too. Last year, a little more than 2,000 people filed unemployment claims after getting laid off from a retail gig. That's down from a peak of more than 7,000 in 2009, according to numbers from the Illinois Department of Employment Security.
That's why we exist, because when that worker walks through our doors, we know that we're seeing them at their worst. We're seeing on their very worst day.
Bridget Altenberg is the CEO of the Chicago-based National ABLE Network. The nonprofit offers job training programs, resume help, and other resources to help get people back to work. But that task is getting tougher.
As the economy improves somewhat overall, the people that are getting left behind are people that need more help. They may have education, literacy, technology gaps.
That's often retail workers. The ABLE Network trains clients for other types of jobs, like in healthcare, transportation, logistics, and information technology. Alfred Tompkins spent more than a decade working for Walgreens in the Chicago suburbs before losing his assistant manager's job there. Tompkins went through an information technology training program with the National ABLE Network. He has some advice for young people working in retail now.
Don't necessarily look back and think, okay, Toys R Us closed, I'm no longer working here, now I need to find another retail. I wouldn't necessarily limit it like that. I would actually avoid that.
Retraining and a new career worked out for Tompkins. Meanwhile, on a macro scale, some more in Illinois may not be ready to pivot just as easily. Bob Bruno is a professor of labor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He says Illinois is well-positioned to attract more fulfillment centers to serve e-commerce businesses and replace some of the lost retail jobs. Its location in the middle of the country, its infrastructure, and trained workforce are all advantages.
But clearly prolonged conflicts and struggles over passing a full-year budget, properly funding education, both higher education, K-12, community colleges, any continual difficulty in making those kinds of investments will slow down or will make it difficult for the state to take advantage of what are some really good fundamentals.
Bruno predicts Illinois will see more closings and layoffs in the months ahead. I'm Mary Hansen.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Artistic inspiration can come from all sorts of places, from a change in relationship to a line from a song. Both of those things inform the work of a photographer showing at the University Galleries. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of The Date Book.
A collection of photographs by artist Raina Young is currently on view at the University Galleries in Uptown Normal. Curated by the University Galleries' Kendra Pates, The Rug's Topography is the name of the show. Raina Young says it's also a song lyric from the band Failure and the album Fantastic Plastic.
The album in its entirety is heavily rooted in transition, and so it's about transition for me.
So is there something you're transitioning in as an artist?
Personally and within the work, I'm dealing with transition, so I'm discussing the transition from my intimate relationship with my former partner, so transitioning from a romantic to a platonic partnership, but also the transition that my former partner was facing with their gender identity, so transitioning from identifying as male to identifying as female.
And is this who we see in many of these photographs here?
Yes. Maddie, my former partner, serves in all of the portraits in the Rug's Topography.
So why, Kendra? Why this show? Why right now?
One of our photo faculty members, Jason Riblando, had invited me to serve as a portfolio reviewer for a conference. And Raina was one of the artists that I had a portfolio review with. And, you know, I met with several artists that day. But Raina sat down, and she had examples of this work. And I was blown away by it, and she had just finished grad school, which I couldn't believe because the work was so accomplished, and just the content of it really resonated with me, and we connected on a personal level, too. I mean, we hugged at the end of this session. I've never hugged somebody at the end of a portfolio review, but with the nature, you know, these transitions that she's talking about, just by the very nature of sitting down and discussing that with somebody, you know, there's this kind of vulnerability and this kind of trust, like at the end of it, I felt like we had a connection, and I kept thinking about the work then. So that was a good indicator to me also that there was something really there, something of substance. In the fall, we had an exhibition of a Philadelphia-based artist, Amy Cousins, and she was dealing with radical queer histories and protest ephemera, and we had a lot of programming associated with that and a lot of support, a lot of excitement about that exhibition. And although the works are very different, both in their approach and sort of what they're dealing with, I felt like there was a need to keep addressing a lot of issues that the LGBTQ community and their allies and their supporters are dealing with. And putting it in this specific room, this is a more intimate gallery. You're able to come in and be surrounded by the work. Then a lot of times I leave a lot of space around work, but it felt really important to have a lot of the works represented, to see the variety of approaches that Raina had. You know, there are pieces that function more as these kind of psychological portraits, some that fall more into the portraiture genre. And as you're walking through the room, the first photograph and the last photograph are different views of the same hallway. So this sort of like portal, this sort of transition point, they have very, very different feels as well in terms of the lighting and what you see, the viewpoint.
Raina, let's take a look at some of the photos. There's one right here that caught my eye when we walked in, and this shows your ex-partner with a robe on and patterned stockings, mm-hmm. and he's casting an eye over the shoulder at us, and it's a very interesting expression that we're getting here. Can you tell me about taking this photo and what it was like?
Definitely. Most of the images for the body of work were made in the home we still shared upon romantically separating. But it was important to showcase that kind of threshold between the public and private space. I try to avoid direct eye contact in my work, so there's no reciprocal gaze typically. But this one, I think, kind of teeters on that ambiguity a bit. There's a tension that resides in the image that's really fascinating to me. Whether the viewer is confronting the subject or not is kind of unknown. So we don't really know if we're kind of peering into something we shouldn't see, or we're actually being confronted by the subject. And then obviously there's little clues in there that maybe suggest that something's happening beyond what we might notice at first glance.
Over here on this wall is not a portrait of a person, but it looks like a portrait of an underwear collection. And I just find it to be really interesting, rather sumptuous, actually. Wonderful texture. And it seems like a mixture of, well, you never can tell these days, but it looks like a mixture of male and female undergarments.
Yeah, these sort of ambient photographs I include in the work serve in a couple of ways. So they become visual breaks from portraiture, but also create kind of a metaphor for circumstance. I wanted this one to feel like the undergarments kind of extended beyond the frame, which I guess speaks to this idea of choice and transition and where to begin. And so you're kind of confronted with all of these choices, and like you mentioned, the garments are a bit ambiguous in terms of what gender assignment we look towards with them. They are a mixture of kind of more feminine cut underwear and then more brief style, I guess, underwear as well.
Raina, the photographs are all untitled. Why did you make that choice?
For me, it's about the body of work as a whole. Titling the work I've never felt it to be necessary. I think the body of work for me as a whole becomes a portrait of our relationship and of my kind of perception of our experiences. And so it's really about the collective experience and visualizing everything in a kind of cyclical way. So I didn't want to allude to anything that maybe spoke to a specific order, but also didn't want to give just general descriptions of things.
That's artist Raina Young, along with curator Kendra Pates. The rug's topography continues at the University Gallery through April 1st. I'm Laura Kennedy.
See a gallery of photos from the exhibition at our website, wglt.org.
Say hello to the rug's topography. It holds quite a lot of interest with your face down on it. Say hello.
The Nurse Who Loved Me from the band Failure on Sound Ideas. Kids with a serious case of smarts have always had a home at the Illinois Mathematics and Science Academy in Aurora. It's the rarest of education institutions, a public, affordable boarding school. Wired magazine once called it Hogwarts for hackers. After the budget impasse, lawmakers are pondering a proposal that would welcome students from outside of Illinois, but for a price. Illinois Newsroom's Dusty Rhodes explains.
Democratic State Senator Linda Holmes represents Aurora, where the school is located. The proposal she presented to the Education Committee would be a seismic shift for the Illinois Math and Science Academy, known as IMSA.
This bill will allow IMSA to charge tuition fees and costs associated with room and board to non-Illinois residents.
To understand how big a deal this is, you have to look at who goes to IMSA now. Illinois residents only. With a capacity of 650 students, it's highly competitive but accessible. Families pay as little as $500 per year. Under this new proposal, IMSA President Jose Torres told senators he plans to charge kids from outside Illinois 10 times that amount. Lawmakers from both parties reacted like he had just suggested selling the family farm to a carpetbagger.
Senator Berkman.
I want to echo the comments of Senator McGuire, Senator Rezin, which is this concern that we might be facilitating a process that we've all witnessed within the higher educational community, which is chasing the money.
Torres didn't disagree. The school needs money. IMSA doesn't get funding from property taxes, and it can't sell bonds. About 80% of its budget comes from the state. But with the budget standoff for the past few years, the state hasn't helped pay for even basic repairs.
In the fall of 2014, I came to this body and it said, we have two boilers. One boiler is redlined. We don't have capacity to pay for another boiler. And I did that for 3 years.
So Torres has gotten creative. He plans to bring in students from outside Illinois and use their tuition dollars to build a new dorm. It would expand capacity to 900 students. But even though scores of qualified Illinois kids are turned away each year, Torres would hold the number of Illinois students at its current level, 650. That's a problem for Sue Rezin, Republican from Morris. She raises the question her fellow senators have on their minds.
I'm still conflicted, though, regarding the out-of-state tuition. We have the same issue with the University of Illinois. It's a very controversial topic.
There's a perception that the U of I's main campus admits so many international students paying full tuition that homegrown Illinois residents are displaced. Andy Menar, a Democrat from Bunker Hill, even offered some proof.
A couple of weeks ago, Mr. Bowman from the Board of Higher Ed was sitting in that chair right in the middle, and he gave possibly the worst answer I've ever heard regarding the balance of in-state and out-of-state students, particularly at the University of Illinois.
Here's what Al Bowman, director of the Board of Higher Ed, said at that time.
I mean, if you have 5,000 students from mainland China paying out-of-state tuition, what's the incentive for them to discount to an in-state youngster in order to land that resident?
Lawmakers want to make sure this same priority shift does not happen at IMSA. Torres reiterated his pledge to hold 650 IMSA beds for Illinois residents. Senator Holmes promised to amend her proposal to bake that pledge into her bill, and the committee approved it to move to the full Senate. Afterwards, Holmes said she didn't expect that pushback.
I thought they'd look at the track record of going 2.5 years with that budget impasse, because that devastated IMSA. And I thought we were going to lose them. So now when you figure, okay, they're looking at ways, how do they become less dependent on state funds? To me, it was just a move that really made sense.
The plan is still in preliminary stages. Even if this bill is passed, it will be several years before IMSA could enroll students from outside Illinois. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration focused on expanding coverage of education, health, and the environment, and state politics. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Let us know what you think of the show. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. I'm Mike McCurdy.